or not so. Please find a comfortable position or go directly to meditation. Let's begin as we've done before, settling body, speech, and mind, then mindfulness of breathing. Then release all grasping, all targeting of any mental object, and let your awareness float in space, without moving, without a direction. Simply being present and knowing that it is present. And allow your awareness to gently descend, settling at your heart. The nucleus of your awareness, the sense of observing some place or from some place, from a perspective, that nucleus of awareness, upon close investigation, is empty, indivisible from space itself. Illuminating all of space, coextensive with space. And now let that space take form, symbolically, as a radiant orb of white light as before, symbolizing your Buddha nature. Now we turn to the next aphorism, which runs, at least as a paraphrase, look upon the kindness of all sentient beings. So let's consider, first of all, our hedonic And so we turned first to those around us who have contributed to our hedonic well-being, our survival, our health, our lives, to enable us to survive and to enjoy life. Attend to those from childhood on, infancy on. Who have contributed to your well-being, either knowingly, directly, with conscious kindness, or those many, many others, countless others, in dependence upon whom we are able to be here today, well-fed, comfortable, well-clothed, but without whose kindness we would not be. Reflect upon the profound interdependence with all the beings around us, and with each out-breath, breathe out the light of gratitude, of rejoicing in others' kindness. Breathe out the light of loving kindness, wishing each one well as we aspire to repay their kindness. Then turn your attention to those who have guided you on your spiritual path, help you to spiritually flourish. These could be authors of books, great beings from the past, your spiritual friends, your teachers, lamas. Reflect upon their kindness, without whom you would have no dharma. There'd be no path for you to follow. Breathe out the light of gratitude, the light of loving kindness. And finally, it's not enough to receive the kindness of others for our material well-being and to receive sound teachings and guidance and spiritual companionship. It's also necessary to encounter a wide range of people, including those who catalyze our own mental afflictions, including anger, resentment, and so on. Difficult people. Their motivation's probably not one of kindness, wanting to assist us, but in reality, they provide us with the opportunity to see our mental afflictions, which might otherwise lie dormant, to see them, to address them, and thereby to be enabled to apply appropriate antidotes and free ourselves from them. So attend even to the kindness in this regard of those people with whom you've had difficulty, who may have treated you badly, because it's independence upon them that we cultivate patience and other virtues, recognize and overcome the afflictions of our own minds. Breathe out the light of loving kindness. Release all appearances, all objects of mind, and let your awareness rest in its own nature. Oh, lasso. Especially since we're coming to the end of the week, I'd like to just wrap up one loose end. The source that I was looking at in terms of those four yogas of Mahamudra, the source itself was faulty. And so I found a better one. Let's see if I can call it up. There we go. Yes, it is. So this is from a complete source. This is from another of the accomplished Mahamudra masters named Jay Gyari. This is reported in the same text, Moonlight of Mahamudra by Dapo Dashi Namgyel, very famous contemplative. And so just to wrap this up in terms of the four yogas and how these map onto the five paths. He says the yoga of one-pointedness corresponds to the paths of accumulation and adjoining, or application as you wish. So the first two paths. So that's where it starts with the achievement of shamatha, and then the union of shamatha, and then the insight into emptiness becomes deeper and deeper and deeper, not yet fully non-conceptual, but it's very transformative. And so that's, so the first yoga is comprised of the first two paths, and then the yoga of the freedom from conceptual elaboration, or simply simplicity, corresponds exactly to the path of seeing, the first bhumi, the first Arya Bodhisattva bhumi. And so that simplicity, that freedom from elaboration would be, now your mind has gone to kind of absolute zero Kelvin in terms of conceptualization. As you might recall, when you settle into the substrate consciousness, it's blissful, luminous, and non-conceptual. But if you ask, is it completely non-conceptual? The answer is no. It's very subtly conceptual. But it's not eradicated altogether. And so it's only in the direct non-conceptual realization of emptiness that conceptualization goes completely down to zero. And there you have this unmediated, non-dual realization of emptiness, and so that simplicity. And it is freedom, exactly a freedom of conceptual elaboration. Okay, so that's the Mahamudra, the yoga of simplicity. Then the third one, one taste. This is for the path of meditation, which is the very next path. And it's basically the second through the eighth bhumis, the Arya Bodhisattva bhumis. This is the one taste. So I commented on that this morning. Not much words needed now. This is where you have not only the realization of emptiness, but very explicitly, you have this direct realization of Rikpa itself, of pristine awareness. And then finally, non-meditation. The fourth and final of the yogis is the rest of the path, that is the bhumis 9 through 13. So there's different enumerations of the Buddhas, but this is all the way up to Buddhahood. So that's that. So we finished that one. That's just the big map. Very sketchy, just a few dots. But then that's good to have the large framework for the reasons that I discussed this morning. So the next aphorism, as we go back and to the text, the 7-point mind training. And so this is non-dually cherishing sentient beings. So we see here, especially from this point, and then there'll be some more aphorisms after this, he's really drawing in the teachings and practices pertaining to ultimate bodhicitta, and now weaving these into how do you transform all circumstances, including adversity, into the spiritual path. So a non-dual cherishing of sentient beings, and the aphorism is meditate on everyone as being kind. Gunla kadin chewara gom. I remember it now in Tibetan. Meditate on everyone as being kind. Now, once again, as in so many cases in Buddhism, there's an unintelligent way of approaching that and the intelligent way of approaching that. So the unintelligent way is flat, and that is really everybody around you just has only kind thoughts, including, you know, thieves and robbers and people in jail and so forth and so on, and that's kind of silly. So this is not an exercise to stupefy ourselves, but it is looking then more deeply. What does this mean? Well, it doesn't really make any sense if we are still apprehending, grasping onto everyone around us as being inherently real, having their own inherently real minds, attitudes, motivations, and so forth. Because we know for ourselves, sometimes we're not feeling kind at all. We may be a bit selfish, a bit greedy, a bit resentful, and so forth, and we may act on that. So on that level, there's no way to say at the same time, oh, I'm feeling quite resentful and I want to retaliate, but I'm also feeling very kind. This just doesn't make any sense at all. So now we have to see there are multiple layers here. And it starts, kind of your baseline, is to recognize, and this is a deep one, it's going back to the first teachings on ultimate bodhicitta, that there's no one out there in surrounding us who is inherently a sentient being. They certainly look that way and they act that way. But then exactly the same thing is true when we're dreaming. When we're dreaming, we seem to be surrounded by all kinds of people, and they don't seem to be enlightened, at least unless you have really nice dreams. But the people we meet in the dreams, they have their own agenda. I've mentioned quite a few times, I think it was the second lucid dream I had a long time ago, where I was lucid and I went into a diner and I was so enthusiastic, I was so, you know, inspired, jubilant, euphoric that I was having a lucid dream. And the first thing I wanted to know, a lot of you heard this dream, it's not terribly interesting, but I was just so eager to know, you know, does anybody else here in the dream know this is a dream? So I'm going from one person to the diner as they're all crouching over their hamburgers and french fries and cokes and so forth. Do you know this is a dream? Do you know this is a dream? And I didn't know what they're going to say. It's in a dream. Even though I'm lucid, one could think they're going to just read your script. Yes, I am. Thank you so much, Alan. I'm also lucid like you are. But no, it wasn't the case at all. I tried to arouse some interest in them. Like, maybe this is a dream, you know? And I didn't find a single person who was interested in the question. They went into the diner to get some fast food. That's what they got. They were munching the hamburgers. And they just thought I was a nuisance. And not even one would say yes or no. They just, and back to their hamburgers, you know. And so quite clearly, I mean, it was my second lucid dream. So, but there they were. They really seemed to be quite autonomous. I didn't know what they were going to say. I thought they'd say something more interesting than that. That was a little bit discouraging. But they seem to be there. They appear to be there, even though you're lucid. They appear to be there, and you don't know how they're going to behave. So it seems like they have their own thoughts. You can't see them unless you're having a clairvoyant lucid dream. But there they are. They seem to be autonomous. And that's commonly true. They're not just little puppets on the string. You know, doing exactly what everybody, you know, doing each one what you expect they're going to do. They seem to be autonomous. Well, and then they're not. And you know that if you're lucid, that in fact you are everyone there. It's very cool. I mean, it's such a marvelous metaphor. Insofar as you're lucid, you know that, number one, there's nobody else there in the dream. There's nobody there. Nobody else has a mind stream. Nobody else has a mother. Nobody, you know, none of those people in the dream had a mother. They're just fresh creations, and they're all going to just vanish into thin air, into the space of the mind as soon as the dream's over. And so none of them are really there. But for that matter, you're not really there either. This person that I was in the diner going from one person to another, over, you know, crouched over the counter, eating their food, I wasn't really there either. If you said, oh, do you have a mother? No. That person in the dream that I was identifying with, I don't have a mother either. And so I wasn't that person because there was no one there. It was like just an illusion, an apparition, an empty appearance of myself in that dream. Everybody else was an empty appearance. So from one perspective, we can say, I'm nobody. That is, I'm nobody. In this dream, I'm not there. Because these are just all empty illusions. No one's there, therefore I'm not there either, from one perspective. From another perspective, I'm equally there all over because everything there is equally. An effulgence, a creation of my awareness, not somebody else's. It wasn't a team effort. It was only coming out of my mind. That means they had to be all equally me. All equally not me. But conventionally, well, okay, there are people there. I guess they're all me. And so if we start doing a little analysis of that, part of me, and this is actually completely true, symbolized in the fact that they had no interest and were not even willing to address the question, is that part of me was jubilantly lucid. I knew I was dreaming. But many aspects of my mind were not lucid. And they were being represented by all of these people in the dream who just wanted to eat their hamburgers. Right? But they're all me. So quite clearly, for most of us, the vast majority of us, when we have our first, second, third lucid dream, we're not completely lucid. If I had tried to walk through walls in that dream, I doubt that I would have made it. Right? That takes a little bit of practice. And then more practice. Then you're doing the transformation and emanation as you're practicing dream yoga. And then you're learning through practice how you can, in fact, transform anything in the dream. But that insight doesn't come all at once. Right? And walking through walls, walking on water, breathing underwater, that's a fun one. And some of you have already tried that. It works. You can breathe underwater, even without growing gills. So it's that type of insight, excuse me. To approximate that kind of insight in the waking state. If we take that very powerful metaphor again from quantum cosmology or quantum physics altogether, before you make the measurement, nothing is already absolutely, inherently, objectively there, such that you're merely the witness of something that was inherently existent, already had, how do you say, defined its own borders, already had its own characteristics, and so you're just passively witnessing. Not true. Not true in quantum cosmology, not true in Madhyamaka. Until you make the measurement, it's just a field of potential. And likewise in Madhyamaka, until you attend, until you direct your attention to, what your attention, what comes to mind, and this is, I'm choosing my words really carefully now, prior to attending to, what comes to mind when you do attend, what comes to mind when you do attend, wasn't already there. There was a potential for it, and then it arose relative to your perspective. Now, does this mean that when I'm not looking at Paolo, that somebody disappears, his mother now, you know, she just lost her son? Of course not. Silly. But from this perspective, the Paolo that arises to me doesn't exist. The Paolo that arises to me doesn't exist before I make the measurement, I attend, and then he arises relative to me. And then Rhonda looks over at him, and then Paolo arises relative to her, and so forth. But you say, no, but there must be a real Paolo there. Well, no. Paolo can arise relative to Paolo, but that's just one more perspective. It's not God's perspective. It's not an ultimate perspective. It's just one more. And some of you have already been finding, especially in awareness of awareness, that you disappear to yourselves. You're totally present, but the sense of your being a person vanishes. You're totally present, but all there is just awareness. And there's no person, man, woman, old, young, ethnic group, and all of that. No one there. There's just awareness and space. And then concepts come in, and then a sense of I forms again, but then it may dissolve again. So it wasn't already there. So for the moment, what we attend to is reality, and the reality that becomes real for us pertains not only to what we're directing our attention to, but how we're directing our attention, and how we make sense of what appears to us. So we don't need to battle. We're not trying to trick ourselves as we really try to make sense of this aphorism. Meditate on everyone as being kind. We know on this superficial level, conventional level, that's not true. Some people are malevolent, some people benevolent, some people are indifferent, some people, all kinds of people. But for us, relative to us, we can attend to kindness coming our way. Kindness not in the sense that from their own side, by their own nature, they're thinking kind thoughts. That may or may not be true, but that's not really the point here. Am I receiving benefit from them? A person from whom I receive benefit, I'll say that is kindness. You could be walking along a city where you're a stranger and you're lost, and you may come to some stranger and say, can you tell me how to get to such and such a place? And the person said, oh, sure, just take a left here and then go about half, 3 blocks, then they take a right, and it's first on your left right there. You say, thanks, that's very kind of you. No, don't mention it. That's a really ordinary conversation, isn't it? Very kind of you. Thanks so much. Yeah, don't mention it. No problem. Whether it was really kind or not, you don't know. All you know is they gave you the words, and hopefully they were the right direction. Right? But it was kind from your perspective. If the guidance actually did turn out to lead you to the right direction, right place, then we'll call that kindness because it was helpful. So it's in that spirit, independence upon this person, have I received benefit? Going back to Shantideva, I can't quote it directly, but something very close. He says, as I simply am walking along the streets in the marketplace or what have you, and I attend to just people who come into my field of vision, he said, I shall look upon each one and think it's independence upon this person that I can achieve enlightenment. Independence upon this person I can achieve enlightenment. And this one, this one, this one. with no one excluded. Right? Because what he's referring to, and this is just a way of shifting our way of viewing others, and yeah, there's so much to be said here, and I don't want to just keep on going on and on. But it's true. And that is in this massive interdependence of sentient beings on the planet, directly or indirectly, the chances are, and whether it's in this lifetime or another lifetime, it's independence upon exactly people like this, that we have our computers, we have our clothing, we have a clock, we have eyeglasses, we have food, we have air conditioning, we have a place to assemble, and so forth and so on. The list goes on indefinitely. And it's precisely because of the people here, it's kind of obvious, in Tanyapura, because of their kindness, that we have, that we can thrive, we can survive, we can flourish. So there's on this hedonic level, just bringing this forth, and here's a crucial point, and that is these practices where we're really generating a thought, and generating, developing, right, a perspective that wasn't there already. Whenever we see that taking place, and you'll see a lot of teachings, this is the developmental approach, right? Looking upon all sentient beings as being your mother, all sentient beings as being kind, and so forth, and many ways of shifting the perspective. What I've found as I've engaged in these practices, reflected upon them, that whenever there's a suggestion like that, like view all sentient beings as being kind, it's directly counteracting another thought that is impeding us, that's blocking our way on our spiritual path. And the natural thought is, the one that comes very easily, especially when we take appearances at face value, everybody's really out there, inherently existent, absolutely existent, and I'm simply witnessing them. When we have that as our baseline, reifying everything, I'm absolutely over here, you're absolutely over there, then what easily comes to mind is, all of these people, they're irrelevant to me. We're not connected. We're not connected. I there's just no connection. They're just different. They have their stuff, and I have my. They're Thai. I'm not Thai. I'm an American. They don't speak that good English, and I don't speak any Thai. And just feeling a total sense of a disconnect. You're irrelevant to me. I'm irrelevant to you. We're unrelated. And taking that as the baseline, it's easy to do. It's easy to do because people really seem to be totally over there with nothing in between. But if we do that, then aloof indifference is bound to be following in the footsteps of that. Because they see no relationship, right? Well, that's crippling. And it's also not true. So, to substitute this sense of being kind. In terms of cultivating a love for, now this is for the stranger. The cultivation of love regarding all sentient beings as being your own kin, that is, your family members. Look upon them with affection, holding them with kindness, protect them from harm, and provide them with happiness. That sense of kinship is really central to this aphorism, in a way just discussed. And then the cultivation of compassion towards everyone around. Even when some individuals, on occasion, now and then, they harm us in some way, whether intentionally or unintentionally, then the response here that we can bring forth, we can cultivate, is the thought, they harm me solely out of delusion. Even if they did it out of malevolence or greed or selfishness, or dishonesty, and so forth, some mental affliction really operative. All of those mental afflictions, they're all derivative of one, and that is one with two aspects to it, unknowing, and then, that is, unawareness, ignorance, and then the active misconstrual of reality, namely delusion. They thought this would be in their best interest, but if we treat others with mental afflictions, it's not. So they harm me solely out of delusion, but in the past they have served me, and due to their mental afflictions, they continue to wander helplessly in the cycle of existence. So reflecting upon that definitely moves the heart. So we can practice Donglin. And then, final point here, just in the notes, and I'm going to bring in a question here. The notes say, just reflect upon the spiritual value of the wide range of human experience. Take a classic example from Buddhism. Deva realms. God realms, or Deva realms. In the desire realm, for example, there's also Devas in the form realm. There's even Devas in the formless realm. But thinking especially of those in the desire realm, if you read descriptions of these Deva realms, they're a lot like Tanyapura, just a lot better. You know, everything gorgeous, no old people. no chubby people, no really skinny people, no ugly people. They're just everybody's beautiful, bodies of light, gorgeous, food is scrumptious, sounds, music, scents, fragrances. It's just, you're just surrounded by hedonic pleasure, and you look pretty good yourself, you know. And so it said you can be born there. Like, it's really much, very much like just having a marvelous dream. You wake up, just you're smiling, you know, your grin goes ear to ear. Like, I had this fantastic dream. It was so sweet. It was so cool. It was so pleasant. It was just gorgeous. And that's little birth in a deva realm. And so it sounds really nice. It is really nice. But it's also said to be utterly sterile in terms of your eudaimonic well-being, in terms of really moving along a path, spiritual evolution, transformation, moving towards awakening. And the simple reason for that is everything's so nice, apart from craving and attachment, no mental afflictions come up. You're not challenged. You have no incentive whatsoever for practicing Dharma. Because who needs Dharma when you're already so happy because everything's going your way? It's just so nice. You just want to hug everybody. Isn't life wonderful? Don't you like being a deva? I do, you know. And you have no incentive for doing anything else besides enjoying your good fortune. Right? And so, in that regard, it said being born in a deva realm is not all that it's cracked up to be. That's because, of course, sooner or later, you don't get actually old and wrinkly and get a pot belly and get asthma as a deva. But it said, I'll just tell you what the whole tradition says, is that at some point, like, they'll wear flowers in their hair, the flowers start to wilt. Just the flowers wilting, you know. And that's the indicator. That's the outer sign. Your time is running out. Your deva life, it's ticking away. And now there's the indication. You know, get ready to move. Pack your bags. You're leaving soon. And it is said when the other devas see that, they get really creeped out, kind of freaked out. And then you see it, and you're getting freaked out because this was so cool. You're intensely attached to it. You don't have any idea where you're going. You've just used up a whole bunch of good karma that got you nowhere at all. And now you're seeing it's all coming to an end. And they say the mental anguish when you're just about to leave the deva realm is quite awful because wherever you're going, probably it's worse. So one thinks then, if one looks for a human analog, people who have experienced kind of like the peak of samsara within the human realm. I mean, good looks and wealth and fame and beauty and sensual enjoyments and prestige and status and all of that. And then something happens and then it's just all lost. Or how many times, every time there's a great big economic slump, including in 2008, how many times do we hear about investment bankers, stockbrokers jumping out of top story, you know, buildings? Because they had it so good and now everything is lost and they see everything hopeless and they'd rather die than face the consequences. So that's been going on for a very long time. So the deva realms, so pleasant you never get around to anything meaningful. Miserable realms, like animal realms, hell realms, so miserable or so clouded mentally that you really have no opportunity to practice Dharma. You're overwhelmed by other stuff. But the human realm, we can see the human realm in the Buddhist perspective, with these six realms, the human realm uniquely has the overwhelmingly the broadest range of experience. We know the things that human beings especially can do to each other look like they just came straight out of a hell realm. I mean, you get some of the imagery from hell realms. You say, yeah, but people have done that. They've done that. Exactly what they say are done in hell realm. People have done that to other people. And they have. Torture, concentration camps, and so forth. It's been happening over history for a long time. So we see, well, that's a very close proxy to hell. And then we have the Preta realm, where we have people who's just overwhelming, their whole life's overwhelmed by greed, insatiable greed. You know, they never have enough. And so metaphorically, they're like these Pretas with great big pot bellies, enormous cavernous bellies, and a mouth a bit as big as a pinhole. So they're always hungry. They always want more because they can never fill their appetites. And then people who act really indistinguishably from animals. That happens every day, you know. Just basically, you know, two-legged animal. But in terms of their motivations, their appetites, their behavior and so forth, you say, where's the difference? I mean, you really are a naked ape. Or perhaps behaving a lot worse than even a lot of apes. So we can see very good replications of animals in the human realm. We have the so-called the asuras, demigods. It's all about power for them. It's really all about power. And then jealousy for those who have greater power. Ever hear of anybody like that? And then the devas themselves. Of course, there are people, very, very fortunate people, who we see them especially in the entertainment industry, in the music industry. They look fantastic. They behave fantastically in terms of their great actors, their great musicians. The music coming from their lips is just like angelic, you know, some of the singers. They've got wealth, they've got prestige, they have sensual pleasures, everything there. You say, okay, great, you're a deva. That's a human approximation of a deva existence. And there are places like that, places that look rather deva-ish. This is a pretty good example here, Phuket, and the Tanyapura within Phuket. So there's a broad spectrum, that having that spectrum, even in one life, having, if not probably for most of us, not the hell realm of like being tortured in a concentration camp, but we've all had times, very difficult times. We've also had some deva-ish times, at least many of us have, and then everything in between. And it's that range of experience that enables us to apply all that we know to Dharma to bring about the most thorough and deep transformation. And so to be grateful for each one. So I'll address this question here because it's related. And the question is from Nicola. So you've spoken of other contemplative traditions at their deepest level converging in upon the insights of Buddhism. It's so most evident to me is not Buddhism as a whole, like the 12 links of dependent origination. I don't see anything like that in other schools. And there are a number of other aspects of Buddhism that seem really quite unique to Buddhism. But from my perspective, just my opinion, but I am a comparative, that's where I did my professional training in religious studies, in comparative mysticism. It does seem to me that it's in this domain of Dzogchen, or Mahamudra, that in my reading, and it goes back 43 years, to the first book that I read that really caught my attention in this regard was the book, The Perennial Philosophy by Aldous Huxley. I haven't read it for a long, long time, but it's really quite a provocative read, because he's making that point, that on the deepest level, there's a convergence upon some very simple but extremely profound points. That's the perennial philosophy. And having then read a lot and then done my doctorate in this field, it appears to me that there is a tremendous resonance in terms of teachings of Dzogchen, which again, in the Nyingma tradition, some other traditions, is considered the pinnacle, you know, the highest, the most profound. And then finding similar things in the Kabbalah, in the Jewish tradition, in the Advaita Vedanta, it's kind of obvious. In Taoism, strong resonance. In the Neoplatonic tradition of Christianity, strong resonance. The Sufi tradition, again, strong resonance. And then even, as I've suggested, Fritjof Capra with his Tao of Physics, which I thought was pretty good physics and not very good scholarship for let's say, the contemplative, but nevertheless, he made some really provocative points that maybe there's some deep resonance here in very deep mystical insights and in quantum mechanics. So I've checked that out rather seriously over the intervening decades since I first read it, written a couple of several books on that. And it does appear to me in quantum cosmology, again, a very, very meaningful resonance. So on that level, not on all level, but on that level, it really appears to me like in a perspectival perspectival drawing or painting, you have the vanishing point where the lines are all going, and some lines may get all the way to it, others get, but they're all pointing in the same direction. It seems something like that to me. That's my perspective. But this is going on. Do any of these other traditions have comparable descriptions of the different realms of existence, such as hell, hungry ghosts, deva, god realms, as in theory for me, if they achieve shamatha, they should gain access to their past lives. And I'll just finish this question. Did Jesus, regarded by many as a highly realized being, ever speak of the different realms of existence, apart from eternal heaven and hell, our reincarnation, as reincarnation was part of early Christian belief? And it was. In fact, a friend of mine, a very dear friend of mine, another Benedictine monk, this one by the name of Lawrence Freeman, sent me a quote I read half an hour ago. And it was written by Origen from the 4th century, I think. But he's one of the church fathers. One of the church fathers, a powerful intellect, a major formulator of Christian doctrine. And he was very explicit. He believed in reincarnation. And so, but now to answer the question. And I'm just relating that to this section of the text. Hell realms, check. Then we have the pretas, hungry ghosts. But there are, this term ghost or spirit, very broad term, if we're trying to map this onto the, this is an English word, of course, spirit or ghost, often used interchangeably. If we try to map this onto Buddhist terminology, it appears to me that it maps onto two categories that are not the same. And that is, one is pretas. Pretas, they're sentient beings, they are spirits, they're not physical, you can't measure them with physical instruments. They can live a long time. And moreover, pretas can haunt a place. They can be like, you know, like a haunted house. If a person dies, and let's say is very, very attached to what during their life, they're very attached to their home, right? Really intensely attached. And then they die. And the attachment to their home was really a very predominant aspect of their mentality. They may die, go through the bardo, and then be reborn as a preta who haunts that house. So then you have, you know, a ghost that haunts a house. There are these pretas that will inhabit other areas, a swamp, a place. And so they're spirits, but they're pretas. And they may last a long, long time. Their lifespan can go on for hundreds of years. And then we have beings in the bardo. The bardo is much more transient. It's said, if we read it really literally, maxed out at 49 days, and then you've gone someplace else. It's just kind of a way station to go someplace else. But they're spirits for sure. They're intangible, but they still can be in a certain place. It is said that as a being the bardo, you may witness your own funeral and see what people are saying about you, and you're clairvoyant, so you can also see what they're thinking about you. So you're not a preta, and you're there only for a short time, but you pass through the bardo, and then you go on someplace else. But there's a spirit. Bardo beings are clearly spirits, but they're not the same as preta, but there's an umbrella term covering both. And so there has been a view in Christianity, and I think one aspect of it just got lopped off. Was it the limbo, I think it was the limbo that just got knocked out, wasn't it? The last pope, Benedict, he just knocked out limbo, yeah? It had been around for some hundreds of years. It's not in the Bible, otherwise he wouldn't have knocked it out. It's not in the New Testament or the Old Testament. It was filled in as kind of like a conceptual category that was felt by some Roman Catholic theologians to be necessary as a kind of a holding place, a limbo. But a limbo then would be, you know, like the bardo, but goes on for a really long time. And then what's the other one? Heaven, hell, life, limbo, and then purgatory. Purgatory is another one. And I think that one's still there. It's also, I don't think there's any reference to it in the Bible, but that's still there, part of Roman Catholic. So the point there being that in Christianity, the notion of there being some intermediate period following your death here and then going someplace else, that's there. So the bardo beings is something like that. But in terms of the spirits, it's all over the New Testament, and you find it elsewhere also. And that is, for example, in one case, there was a man who was possessed by demons, by spirits, a lot of them. And so he was quite, you know, mentally in chaos, because he had these multiple voices, multiple beings who had really kind of taken over his stream of consciousness. And it was terrible for him. And if you know the story, Jesus came on and performed an exorcism, and a lot of them, and he got them all out, and then, for reasons best known to Jesus, because I don't understand, he then took that whole swarm of these demons and he planted them, he sent them off to a herd of swine, of pigs, and I think then they ran off and jumped over a cliff or something. And so that sounds kind of like a preta. They wouldn't be bardo beings. They sound like pretas to me. And a preta or pretas, a whole gang of them coming in and then possessing somebody and then being expelled. Well, the Roman Catholic Church has been doing that for a very long time. And this could be pretas. I mean, what else? They're not animals. They're not hell beings. So why not pretas? Because they actually possessed the pigs, and then the pigs felt themselves to be possessed, and then they freaked out. So taking care of those, taking care of the animals, of course, then human beings. And then in terms of the devas, well, there are the seraphim and the cherubim and there are angels, and so there's a whole category of beings who are not God. They're not the Son of God, but there's a whole spectrum there, you know. And so might they be devas? Could be. Why not? They're certainly not human beings. They're not any of the preceding. And so that gets pretty close to the whole. And then, of course, the Pure Lands. Well, that's where you go with Jesus. He's not just hanging out in a deva realm. So Pure Land would be there. But what I found interesting here, if we jump tracks just a little bit, this is more just kind of background. It's the end of the week. We don't have to be serious all the time. Pythagoras. Pythagoras was one fascinating individual. He was a contemporary of the Buddha, brilliant man. He really was in some very deep ways unlike the other early Greek thinkers, the Ionian sages, Heraclitus, Thales, Democritus, and others, living there in the 4th to 6th century before the Common Era. They were thinkers. Thales was a thinker, Heraclitus a thinker, Democritus, big-time thinker, materialist. And so they were doing philosophy. Quite good. They were the founders of Western philosophy. Pythagoras was, of course, a thinker. He was a mathematician as well, famous for his Pythagorean theorem, which he probably borrowed from India, because they had already invented it when he came along. The Jains in India had already developed it. But what's remarkable about Pythagoras, that he was not just a thinker, a mathematician, a philosopher, but he was also a contemplative. He very clearly had very profound samadhi. He had achieved shamatha, probably beyond shamatha, but at least shamatha he must have achieved. He traveled to the east. It's hard to tell how far. He was very curious. He didn't stay just in the Mediterranean basin. He made it at least as far as Egypt. At least as far as Egypt. So still Mediterranean basin, but south side. And it's said that he went down there and he learned the wisdom of the east, some of the wisdom of the east in Egypt. And there are tales, legends, but not confirmed, not really clear or definitive, that he traveled further east from there. He went on east farther, maybe to Babylon, nobody is really quite clear. But he did travel, he did seek for wisdom outside of Greek culture, at least to Egypt. And then at that time, he's a contemporary of the Buddha, so about the 6th century before the Common Era. At that time, historians know that there were these, they were called gymnosophists. A little bit later in Alexandria, under Alexander the Great, that's something like 3rd century before the Common Era. But during the time of the Buddha, there were already these gymnosophists. These were yogis from India. The Indians at that time were really seafarers, and they would travel over to Africa, to the Near East, and they were merchants, so they were traders. And so they made their way to Macedonia, to Egypt, and so forth. They were traveling back and forth. It's not that far. And so we know that there was commerce going back and forth between India and the Near East at that time. And it seems the historical evidence indicates also that there were yogis. Now, they would have been non-Buddhist yogis, because this is at the time of the Buddha, so he didn't have it. I don't think his disciples got off the mark that quick. But bear in mind, at the time of the Buddha, samadhi was already extremely well developed in India, and probably uniquely in India. I see no evidence that it was developed in China, the Mayan tradition, the Roman, nobody else. As far as I can tell, Indians were the first ones to develop very deep states of samadhi. And so, if Pythagoras made his way to Egypt, now this is speculation, but it's really quite plausible that he could have met some Indian swamis and learned samadhi from them. What is clear from the documentation about Pythagoras is that he claimed not to believe in reincarnation, but to know reincarnation. It is said that he claimed that he could remember 20 of his past lives. And he also asserted that people could be reborn as animals, animals as people. So he's very explicit about that. He's famous for that. And there it is nested in the Greek culture, that Pythagorean continuum carried on through Socrates. He also asserted reincarnation, carried through to Plato, who asserted reincarnation. And I just mentioned Origen of the something like 3rd century of the Common Era, Christian. That same current, the Pythagorean, the Neoplatonic current, carried right through Origen, and the belief then of reincarnation was then part and parcel of not all of Christianity, but he's a church father, so not a heretical part of Christianity, until later it was made heretical. This is hanging out. This is a bit more like chit-chat, but it's interesting. Grist for the mill. But if we go back to Greek, what we moderns call Greek mythology, okay, all the great stories, we all know them as Zeus and Olympus and all of that. Well, if you're looking for asuras, demigods, and for devas, gods, the Greek got plenty of them. And they got their battles and their envy and their wars and so forth. And you got all the demigods, you have all the asuras and all the devas you'd ever want in Greek mythology. But maybe it wasn't just mythology. Maybe people like Pythagoras could actually see them. You know, who knows? He wasn't the only one. There was, you know, something about which we know very little, but the Delphic Oracle, the mystic traditions in ancient Greece, they were very secretive, and they didn't write much down. So we know not much about them, except that they did exist. So But there you get Asuras and you get Devas. And of course, if you then jump over back to India, prior to Buddhism, the Asuras and Devas all over the place. Plenty, plenty. And we call that Indian mythology. But maybe it wasn't just mythology. Okay? So, interesting. Again, big picture. Lasso. The next point's really quite deep, and I don't feel like rushing. We're coming to the end of the week. Questions or comments, insights or observations, experiences you'd like to share pertaining to now shamatha. We've done the whole cycle. And on Monday, I'm going to take you back to the infirmary. But anything about pertaining to any of the practices of shamatha or any of the practices in seven-point mind training thus far? Anything coming up? Or do you want to do one more aphorism? Okay, there we go. Go ahead, Emery, please.
It's on. So when I first begin my practice in a given session,
I can't quite hear.
When I first begin my practice in a given session,
in which session?
In any given session.
In any given session.
When I first sit down on the cushion, I tend to have sort of a bird's eye view of the breath.
You have a bird's eye view of the breath.
Of the breath of my meditation object. And I...
If you can hold that like an ice cream cone, that'll help. There you go. Right pointing at your mouth.
So I guess let me start with you've quoted the Buddha's instruction about when one breathes in long.
When one breathes in long, yes.
Recognizing that one breathes in long and breathes out short, etc. Mm-hmm. And when I first start a given session, I tend to have that I'm in touch with long breaths and short breaths, and I know where I am in a given breath. This is the in breath. This is the out breath. As a session deepens and as my concentration becomes more intense, I tend to lose that bird's eye view, and I get more in touch with the subtler sensations, and I
Let
no longer...
Because I want to understand. I'm going to interrupt only for the sake of understanding.
Okay.
When you speak of a bird's eye view, is this kind of like... Because I've never used that term, so I need to know what you mean by it. Are you referring to something that I've referred to as just your awareness resting in its own place without kind of getting caught up and tangled in or something different?
No, I'm referring to... I guess let me use an analogy. Say the breath is similar to a... like a car driving back and forth on a racetrack. And this direction is in and that direction is out, and there's a pause at each end. And I see that whole thing. When I get deeper into the practice, I sort of zoom in and lose the big view.
That's when you lose the bird's eye view.
Sure.
Okay,
yes.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so at that point I'm just, you know, I'm watching the tire of the car on the road.
Gotcha.
And all the little bumps and, you know, here's a pause and here's a smooth section. And mm-hmm. But I don't know where I am, per se. I don't know if this is the in-breath, the out-breath, or if it's long or short. Is it okay to lose touch with, at some point as the in deeper sessions, is it okay to lose touch with that bird's eye view?
In this practice, in this tradition, you don't really want to lose yourself in the object, because that's rather what it sounds like. You've lost kind of the larger picture, and you're down to the bumps in the road and the tire tread. You don't want to get lost in the forest. This is why I've mentioned a number of times now the Russian dolls. And that is, even when you are attending to the sensations, kind of like you're attending to the sensations on the outermost doll, you know, that here it is. I mean, this is the surface of the body. We can't tactily perceive anything outside our skin. Like, I can't sense anything here in front of me unless my hand is there. That although that's what we're illuminating, that's where the attention is focused, we're resting there. We're resting in the stillness of awareness. So we're seeking this theme throughout, the stillness and motion, rather than getting off the throne, off the place of awareness, and then going really immersing ourselves in the the details of this sensation, that sensation, that sensation. Because especially if we carry that over to settling the mind, we'll be then doing the same thing, getting caught in the details of this thought and that thought, in which case that gets pretty darn close to mental wandering, right? So the idea here, if we come back to one of these core practices and such a clear instruction from the Sharvajra Tantra with respect to settling the mind, and that is, first of all, distinguish stillness from motion, and then simultaneously be aware of stillness and motion. But if you've left the stillness of your own awareness and you've kind of really immersed yourself in the motion of the breath, then you'll likely immerse yourself in the motion of thoughts as well, in which case you're not doing the practice. So both tracks may very well have benefits, but for this one, the suggestion, the implication, which I'm quite sure is true, is that we can attend with precision, with detail, with high resolution, even without immersing ourselves in, while still maintaining the bird's eye. So I'll give an analogy, because I know you have more to say. But that is, if you're imagining, you gave the example of cars going back and forth. Okay, if you're up in the bleachers at NASCAR, is that what it's called? So racing, whatever. You can see the whole racetrack. So there's a bird's eye view. And then you see your car, the one you're rooting for, right? And then you get your glasses out, your binoculars, and now you're really honing in on that car, but you've lost the big vision, right? Well, that's way with binoculars. Then, of course, you get a lot more resolution. You see much more, but then you've lost the big picture. And then also you lose the sense of where you're viewing from, because you've kind of immersed in your telescopic vision there. Well, there's another way to do this. If we think of photography, okay, and now we can do this really easily with digital photography, there's another way to get the high resolution, not with binoculars, but with more megapixels, right? So just increase the megapixels. You can have all the detail you can possibly have with just keep on greater density of megapixels, right? And you don't need a telescope, and then you can still maintain the panoramic vision, but have incredible detail. And so that's actually a close analogy. There's more from you, though.
No, I guess that answers it. My other question was just going to be if as you progress along the stages, even at the higher stages, you're still always in touch with this is the in-breath, this is the out-breath, that was a long breath, that was a short breath.
Well, this practice does evolve. So the very first one, breathing in long, breathing out long, I note that I breathe in and out long. And then, just to reiterate, we'll be doing this next week. As the whole system settles, and you've experienced this, you don't need as much oxygen, then quite naturally the breath becomes shorter without you trying to make it so. And sometimes, I don't know what your experience is, everybody is somewhat different, sometimes it kind of gets shorter and shorter incrementally, you know. But I've had the experience where it's going long and then kind of the bottom drops out. And then suddenly it's very short, very shallow. And I'm not gasping for breath, I'm getting all the oxygen I need and there's hardly any breath taking place at all, but it was rather abrupt. So it's just a nyam. That's not a sign of realization. That's just an experience that I'm sharing. But then when that happens, whether incrementally or rather a sudden drop-off to a really shallow breath, breathing in, out, in and out short, then you're simply aware of that. But then that next phase is, and it can be interpreted in two ways. This is a reiteration now. But just to do Theravada style, because I think you're following Theravada style, as I recall, you know, on the apertures of the nostrils. If you're following that route, of course, it's classic, it's absolutely authentic, then we follow Buddha Gosa, and he says, when the Buddha says, attend to the whole breath, breathing in, I attend to the whole breath, breathing out, I attend to the whole breath, the whole body. What he's saying is, what he implies, according to Buddha Gosa, and it's not his ingenious idea, he's drawing on centuries of yogis before him, is you're tending, but now with precision, with kind of a tightly packed continuity, to the entire course of the in-breath, the entire course of the out-breath. So there's a density of megapixels here in terms of just the sheer continuity. That is, you're attending so homogeneously that you're getting so many hits per second of these staccato moments of consciousness, and they're hitting the same target. Breath, 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 breath. Marilyn Monroe. Breath, 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 breath. Okay, Marilyn Monroe. But not many Marilyn Monroes, but, you know, and anything other than the breath. But it's dense, which means you have the sense that there's just, that you're a real continuity, real flow. And that's what he's getting at there, that you're going now for fine stability. You're knocking out the coarse excitation where you completely lose it. But even the medium and the subtle excitation, where you're making these little brief forays or kind of going back and forth between some nattering thought, like a flea, a gnat, kind of buzzing around your head, and you're kind of going back and forth. Well, if we did a meticulous analysis of that, what seems to be simultaneous is that I'm attending to the whole course of in-breath, whole course of out-breath, and I've got this blah, 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 these gnats flying around my head in terms of rumination. It seems like they're taking place simultaneously. And on course level, they are. Over a 1.5-second period, you're getting both the rumination and you are engaging with the breath, and that's simultaneous. During the same 1/2 second, both are happening. But if you went down finer, say, okay, but now how about for 1/20th of a second? How about 1/50th of a second? If you had some way of measuring that, in 1/50th of a second, are you actually experiencing, in that 50th of a second, are you experiencing both the sensation of the breath and the rumination? The Buddhist analysis here is if you get short enough, you're going to find a point at which, nope, you were actually entirely on the rumination, but you came back so quickly that it felt like you were never gone, and it felt like they're simultaneous, but they weren't. You're making these little spikes off, but they're really brief, and you have a sense of continuity with your breath. Well, that continuity gets finer, finer and finer. And then as that goes on from stage 4, 5, 6, 7, and so forth, where you are moving beyond medium excitation, then moving beyond even subtle excitation, there, when you transcend a subtle excitation, you're in a flow there, and you're just having no spikes out. Boom, it's just your object. So that would be really a very dense sequence of moments of attention focus on your meditative object, and that would be really taking to the hilt, or taking to the culmination, what the Buddha was getting at, tend to the whole breath, the whole body of the breath, and don't miss a beat. Don't take any little spiky vacations. Be there the whole time. And when you've done that, so now we're mapping the Buddha's 4 aphorisms to the 9 stages of shamatha. You're doing that on a course level when you hit stage 4. Because then you're not having any major forays where you can entirely, you subjectively, have a sense, I totally forgot the object. I was totally thinking about something else, right? Or off to a visual of the auditory. When you hit stage 4 and you've stabilized there, you have a sense that you're always on the object. But there's medium excitation, there's subtle excitation. But now just fine-tune that attending to the whole body. Fine-tune that as you go through stage 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and then into 9. By the time you get to 8 and 9, then you're attending to the whole body in the sense of being free not only of coarse excitation, which is baked back in stage 4, but even medium and subtle excitation. You're free of those as well. And it's exactly when that happens that you have a sense of the world vanishing. Because all your moments, all your 1/50th of a second, 20 millisecond bursts bursts of cognition are all hitting the same target. It's like throwing darts, and every single dart is hitting the bullseye, And if that means they're all going there, and none of them are missing the target, heading off to the sight, sound, rumination, and so forth, then what you don't attend to, I'm going to just flip William James Brown on his head, and he did it himself, what you don't attend to fades out of reality as far as you're concerned. And that's exactly when, stages 7, 8, 9, it happens quite frequently, fluctuating. You have it, and then it comes back a bit. Have it, comes back again. That is your experience of the sensory environment. But get into stage 8 or 9, and you're really now attending to the whole body of the breath, even on the finest tune level, which means there's just no awareness left over to flow out into the visual field, the auditory, the tactile, or into that whole mental domain where rumination arises, because your mental consciousness is focusing entirely, if it's on tactile sensations, at tactile sensations, or is on the acquired sign. A mental object. There's a point when you recall, you shift from the preliminary sign of the tactile sensations of the nostrils to the acquired sign. And you focus single-pointedly on that, and it has no competition. That is, your attention is now as if you were a civil engineer, and you've taken a river that goes into all kinds of deltas and rivulets and so forth, tributaries, and you just bring it all into one channel, right? Well, that's what you've done with your awareness. You're a civil engineer of awareness. So all the current of your awareness is flowing in one direction only out of six, secondary rivers that it could flow into, the six domains. You've channeled it all into one domain, there into the mental domain, if you're focusing on the acquired sign. All the others are just, they vanish. They dried up as long as you're in samadhi. And so that is now you're really attending to the whole breath, the whole body, the whole body. And then, he says, then breathing in, breathing out, I soothe, I calm the composite of the body, or the body-mind. The whole system calms down. The whole system goes into a state of serenity, of tranquility, of shamatha, because that's what it means. And then, if we slip over into the inter-Tibetan literature, that's when you're really now achieving shamatha, and that's when you have this dramatic shift of the energies within the body. You have the surging, these upheavals of bliss coming up, but then it all settles down. And when those upheavals, now again to reiterate, when those upheavals have finished, you've already focused entirely on the mental domain, but you have this radical shift of the mind becoming subtle, the body becoming subtle, the energy throughout the body going into full, free flow, and then with bliss, and then bliss in the mind, and then that tapers off. Like again, the image that comes to mind is having a pot of milk on the stove, and it's getting hotter and hotter, and then it just goes all over the place. And then you quickly turn the heat down, and then it goes and then simmers. It's like that. Your cup runneth over with bliss, physical bliss, and then mental bliss. But you don't have to turn anything. It'll subside of its own accord, but it really kind of spills all over the place. You're just totally saturated with bliss. You can't do anything. But when that mental bliss, when that subsides, and then you're just simmering, in a sense, in a state of well-being and very manageable joy, with single-pointedness, with the ability to use your intelligence for coarse or subtle investigation or analysis, your mind enormously pliant and supple, but calm, meditative equipoise. That's when you have now soothed the composite of your body-mind. Avichi Shamat. Okay? Okay, good. Anything else coming up? Or shall we shock them and come up early? Aha, yes, Francesca. Oh, yeah, whoever's nearest. Oh, there we go. Thank you. To Francesca.
My question is about merging the mind with space. Uh-huh. And when we do the practice, when we do the practice,
yes,
we do it with the eyes open.
Optimally, yeah, although I know that's okay. Distracting. Yeah.
But then also when I do mindfulness of breathing, it happens to me the breath becomes very, very subtle. And at a certain moment, it's as if the breath was not perceivable.
Imperceptible, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And my experiences of having a kind of merging my mind into space, yes. Also with the eyes closed.
Yes.
And so I would like to know if I'm messing up something or if I'm doing something correct. I don't know.
Neither one. It's not that you're doing it correctly or that you're messing up. Neither one. What you are doing is, within a single session, shifting from one method to another method. And that's not wrong, but it's also not right. It's not like what you should be doing. And that is, when the sensations of the breath get very, very subtle, so that they become imperceptible, you just can't detect them, then if you follow the classic Theravada procedure, which is very well time-tested, exactly that that situation comes up. It's recorded by Buddhaghosa in his Path of Purification. Student comes to the teacher and says this, imperceptible, what to do? And to make a longish story very short, the teacher said, go back and attend more closely. Because you are still breathing, you're not in the womb, you're not dead, and you're not in the fourth, you know, in the fourth jhana or above, you are breathing, which means there have to be sensations there. There have to be sensations there. But the sensations are more subtle. They're subtler than your awareness. And that's why you're not getting anything, because your awareness is relatively coarse. So go back and then attend more closely without seizing up, getting tight and so forth, relaxation with clarity, and then just keep going and just keep on looking. So if the apertures of the nostrils is your target area, number one, you can establish a baseline. The baseline is the sensations that are there with or without the breath. You can actually feel some vibration, some tingling, something there in your target area. And that's there when you hold your breath. Yeah, I got something. Okay? So that's independent of the breath. And so I've got a baseline. I have something to hold on to. I have a target. They speak of the rope of mindfulness, attaching your mind to the meditative object, and the meditative object being the stake in the ground, right? And so the rope of mindfulness is attending there to the target area. You're getting the what I've called the background radiation, the sensations that are there independently of the breath. And then you monitor them very closely. It's just like looking at a screen. And are you seeing, as you're breathing normally, don't hold your breath, are there any fluctuations in that field of sensation as the breath comes in, goes out? And if you attend closely enough, you'll see them, in which case you've re-engaged, and that will continue to let your mind become subtler and subtler and subtler. Okay? So that's one strategy. Now, if we follow a Sangha strategy, you don't need to focus on one little tiny area. You can actually have that awareness be like sheet lightning, your awareness permeating the whole field of the body. But the sensations of the breath will still get very subtle. If you're settling the whole body mind, they will get subtle. But now instead of targeting this very small area by the apertures of the nostrils, you're maintaining this diffuse but very clear awareness that permeates the whole field of the body. And of course, you can feel sensations all over the body. Now that's your background radiation. That's your baseline. But within that baseline of this field of energy, because that's what it feels like, do you sense any fluctuations? And if you're good, good. Then follow those. And as you follow them, and the system gets more and more calm, and more calm, those sensations will get subtler and subtler and subtler. And if you're not getting tight, then you'll have that beautiful synergy of deepening relaxation, deepening stillness, and deepening clarity. Right? Now, the other track, and some of you are following this, is you may follow the Theravada track, and that's focusing right here, as we've done before, right at the apertures of the nostrils, and then keep alert for the occurrence of this acquired sign. I won't elaborate on that right now, but that's a purely mental sign. And when it's quite clear that it's not just some image that happened to come and then it happened to go and, you know, just basically wandering thoughts and images, when it's quite clear that in your really fine sessions, when you're very stable, very clear, an image comes and it comes repeatedly, repeatedly, and starts to crystallize into quite of a set form, a form that keeps on coming back again and again, then say, okay, that's the acquired sign. And then you disengage your attention from the tactile sensations of the breath and you focus on that mental image, the acquired sign, or it's also called learning sign, purely mental image, and you follow that, you keep onto that until that breaks apart, so to speak, and another sign called the counterpart sign arises, and that, Buddha Ghosa says, is 100, nay 1,000 times more subtle than your acquired sign. And if you, as soon as it arises, if you're a gifted person for shamatha and jhana, as soon as it arises, you'll just lock right onto that. It's extremely subtle. It's coming from the form realm. And this is when you've slipped, your whole mind is now shifted from one dimension to another, from the desire realm to the form realm. If you can, and some people are this gifted, as soon as it arises, your mind is so subtle, so perceptive, so fine, that as soon as that very subtle new sign occurs, a mental image occurs, you lock right onto it, and you keep with it. And then you'll slip right through threshold to the first jhana, to the full achievement of the first jhana in the same session. So some gifted people do that, right? Many don't have that degree of subtlety, so the acquired sign, the counterpart sign arises, they note it, they've just crossed the threshold into the form realm because they have ascertained that their whole mind has shifted into the form realm, but that sign is so subtle they can't sustain their attention on it. They lose it. The counterpart sign dissolves back into the form realm. And then they're resting in the bhavanga. Right? They've achieved shamatha. And they're just resting in the bhavanga, and all that's there is the sheer vacuity of what we would call the substrate. Okay, so there's one track. Now I need to finish. It's dinner time, and it's end of the week. But you've shifted technique in the middle of a session. It's not bad. It's not a bad thing to do. But you need to do it consciously, that you know you're now no longer practicing mindfulness of breathing. You've decided to let the mindfulness of breathing be a launching pad for you to go into awareness of awareness or merging mind with space. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. And can I continue with the eyes closed then?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
There's a short answer to that. And it comes from His Holiness. His Holiness was asked, you know, we're not the only people that find it a little bit distracting to have the eyes open. That's why the mind fold is so nice. You have the eyes open and you have no distraction at all. Or, and again, since I, as a Dharma teacher, am not in the business of being a salesman for a company, I've heard now happily, Scott and Rissi have told me of another product that for some people is better. At least one person I know, this is a better product than the Mindfold. And it's the brand name is Bucky. Bucky. Like B-U-C-K-Y. Bucky. It's just a brand name. But it's just another model. And it doesn't give so much pressure. It doesn't have so much plastic. It doesn't have this plastic smell. I'm hearing this secondhand. I've never tried them. It may let in a little bit of light at the bottom. They might not be quite so light-proof, but you don't have so much feeling of pressure on the face. So if you have sensitive sinuses or if you're kind of sensitive to pressure on the head at all, this is less. So for some people, that might be better. Okay? Or other people might just pull the blinds and meditate at night, in which case then you're just meditating in a dark room. But what His Holiness was asked is, if in the practice of settling the mind in its natural state, you start with your eyes open, according to classic instruction. But if in the course of your session, your eyes just naturally close, do you have to flip them open again? And he said, no, let it be. Okay? Hola, so. So, all day. Tomorrow is a day of sheer potentiality. It doesn't exist at all. The measurement has not yet taken place. And so it's ripe, waiting, pregnant, full of energy, possibilities. Some of you are probably thinking about the beach. Whatever you like to do, it's your baby. But it's lying just as a field of potential. And it's also a wonderful opportunity to do something now in this very conducive environment that you might really take delight in replicating when you've gone home. And that is periodically just having one day retreat, either in your own home or finding some other place you can use for one day. And then you will have known, if you've done it here, that you now have set your own schedule entirely with no outside influence, nothing from the outside, just meals. If you've done this 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times here, of doing a one-day retreat entirely on your own with your own structure, everything you designed, and you see that it works, and you've had a very meaningful day, it was fruitful, practice went well, you've enjoyed it, then you do that a few times. And then you have experience-based confidence that when you go elsewhere from here, it was you did it. It wasn't me. It wasn't the group energy. It was you did it. And that'll give you confidence to do your own retreats, whether for one day or weekend or a year. You develop confidence through experience. And I'll just come back to that as a final note, and that is now that we have now finished the first 4 weeks of our retreat, I think you may have noticed I've never asked any of you, what stage are you on? Have you achieved stage 2 yet? Have you achieved 3? I've never, because I'm not even curious. I'm not holding myself back. I don't really care. I'm not curious. These are very important stages, and if it comes up, you want to talk about it, I'm happy to talk about it. But that's not what I'm aspiring for. I'm not in the back of my mind hoping, oh, gosh, I hope you achieve stage 3 or 4 or whatever before we're finished. It never comes to mind. It's not a thought in my mind at all. It's not that I have no thoughts in my mind. I'll tell you the thought that is there. Is that I would really love it. My aspiration is that when we do leave here, we leave with confidence. Confidence. And it's confidence above all in yourself. Right? If it goes beyond that to confidence in the teaching, the teacher, the lineage, and so forth, that's good, that's good. But you're the one that's leaving here. I'm not leaving with you. And so if you have confidence in one or more of the practices, you know how to do it, you feel confident, you know how to do it, and you know that you know how to do it, and you find it meaningful, you find it beneficial, you feel you really know how. And if it's for more than one practice, all the better. And you're inspired to continue. Then from my side, mission accomplished. You leave here with confidence. That's great. And that's doable. 4 weeks, if you don't have that, a lot of you have confidence already. If you don't have confidence yet, 4 weeks is plenty of time. So I wish you confidence that you leave here quite full, meaning I've got a good set of practices here. I know them. I understand them conceptually. I've tasted them experientially. It's good medicine. It's good food. And I'm going to continue my practice If that's your sense, fantastic. And if your sense is, I tried those practices and they don't really work for me at all, I don't really care for them, that's a really good learning experience. Then you know not this teacher, probably not the right one for you, and probably not these teachings, but there are a lot of good teachers out there, a lot of good other teachings. So if you find after 8 weeks, nothing clicked for you, like, wow, just like one long 8-week yawn, nothing worked, then, well, that's still 8 weeks very worthwhile, because you know this probably not the right teacher for you, and these teachings not the right ones for you. But then there's a whole world of other teachings out there, and excellent teachers as well. So then you scratch that one off the list. Not that one. And then you have some knowledge. Look elsewhere. Okay. Either way, most important, you get something really benefits you. That's what I'm here for. Okay. Enjoy your weekend. I'll see you all soon.